All right. So yes, well, Lewis is right. I got into this business and into the stuff I was just telling you about because I was interested in the roles that receptor tyrosine kinases play in neural development. And many years ago, I was just initially interested in the question of how many such genes there were. So 7 that we were talking about before is a receptor tyrosine kinase. And on theoretical grounds, it wasn't clear how many genes there are. In fact, there are remarkably small number of genes. So in your genome, you only have 58 receptor tyrosine kinase genes. And to a first approximation, they play fundamental roles in essentially all aspects of development that relate to cell-cell communication and signaling. So they're among the fundamental regulators of cellular physiology. And we got into the business that I'll tell you about today because we cloned initially, when we were doing this survey, we cloned a number of these receptor tyrosine kinases of the EPH family that I'll tell you about. And we got into the business of retinal tectal topography, which is a very, very old problem in development in general and developmental neurobiology in particular, mainly by looking at their graded distributions. So that's how we sort of got into it. The stuff I'll tell you about today is really primarily that of 3 people. Two of them have actually now left the lab. One's a former postdoc, Arthur Brown, who now heads his own lab in Canada. Paul Yates, who was an MD-PhD student with my colleague Dennis O'Leary, who's right next door, and then a current postdoc from Strasbourg, Michael Rebe. And so the problem I'm going to talk about is really a very old problem. As I said, it relates to basically the representation of sensory information in all sorts of nervous systems. So some of you have probably seen these famous pictures of the homunculus, where you have essentially your entire body surface physically mapped onto somatosensory cortex in the brain. And there's a one-to-one point spatial relationship between the entire surface of your skin and points in the brain. It turns out that this problem is basically reproduced in multiple areas of sensory representations in terms of the representations of frequency and your ability to perceive sound.
Sorry, just a moment. Well, we've got visitors. Come in. Come in.
Hi.
He hasn't said anything important.
Now, pay attention. I just said something important, and you weren't listening. All right, the representation of sound, and also what I'm going to talk about today, representation of sight. So how physically the visual world, which is initially mapped onto your retina, and you can model the retina as a two-dimensional sheet of neurons, how that is mapped onto your brain. This is a very old problem. It preoccupied Leonardo. This is a drawing from one of his anatomical dissections of the nerves of the head, and he was very preoccupied about actually how the eyes were connected to the brain. And he did a lot of dissection. So this is something that scientists have thought about at least since the 15th century. In the last century, there's a famous biologist who did a number of experiments in systems in which the visual projection from the retina to the first relay center in the brain can be experimentally manipulated. This is Roger Sperry, who spent a good chunk of his career working at Caltech. And he did most of the seminal experiments that define the basic parameters of the system that I'm going to talk about. And this is the problem of topographically mapping the retina onto its first relay center in the midbrain. In non-mammalian vertebrates, this structure is called the tectum, so you often see this problem in the literature referred to as the problem of retinal tectal mapping. And essentially it reduces to a simple problem, that is mapping the Cartesian coordinates of a two-dimensional sheet of neurons in your eye onto a corresponding two-dimensional sheet of neurons in the tectum. Now, the way this, I'm only really going to talk about one axis of this projection. If you think about your eye, there are basically two axes you can either model in polar coordinates, or it's more standard to model it in XY coordinates. So there's basically one axis, which is the nasal temporal axis, which is the one I'll talk about, the axis that goes from your nose to the side of your head in each eye, and the dorsal ventral axis. And the nasal temporal axis is the one that's been worked on the most. Sperry defined the basic parameters, and they're shown in that slide. So basically, the way this system works is that retinal ganglion cell neurons that are near the side of your head, so-called temporal neurons, map to the front or the rostral end of the superior colliculus in the midbrain, sort of right here. And those that are near your nose, the nasal ones, map all the way to the back.
The nasal goes to the
I call it caudal because that's sort of the classical anatomical thing. Yeah, I was in this field for about a year before I could remember this. Here's the mnemonic I used, okay? Temporal goes to rostral, that's TR. I remember Teddy Roosevelt, okay, for that. Nasal goes to caudal, I remember NC, North Carolina. So if you remember Teddy Roosevelt in North Carolina, you'll keep this straight. So so that's how it works. And neurons that are in intermediate positions map to correspondingly intermediate positions, that are at intermediate positions along the nasal temporal axis, map to correspondingly intermediate positions along the rostral caudal axis. The mapping is incredibly precise. So this has preoccupied people for a long time. I mean, how mechanistically can you set up this very nice topography? Correspondingly, I won't say anything about it, but the dorsal ventral axis of the eye maps onto the lateral medial axis. So you've got basically, as I said, Cartesian axes that are mapping onto Cartesian axes. This is a problem of topography. You have a point-to-point relationship or nearest neighbor relationships in an input set of neurons that have to be mapped onto their targets. Now, I won't say much about this, but in mammals, in you and I, it's very important. The biology of this process is not something that happens instantaneously. So the axons don't grow from your eye to the target and stop at exactly their right spot, okay? What they actually do is they grow into the target initially, and they pay no attention to this topography, right? And over a period of time of about a week, they actually refine this. So I should maybe just sort of point this out because here's some more about this. So this is a picture of the target. And what you're looking at are axons that have been labeled by a focal injection into one tiny spot in the retina. And they're eventually going to terminate only in this position along the anterior-posterior axis or rostral caudal axis. But at postnatal day one in a mouse, you can't see any topography here. You see they've grown all over the surface, and they have respected neither the rostral caudal nor the medial lateral axis. This is the midbrain. So you're looking down onto the top of a brain, sort of right about here. This is what we call this in mammals is called the superior colliculus. In non-mammalian vertebrates, it's called the tectum. So this may have been a focal injection of a fluorescent tracer which will label all the axons in a very narrow spot. And so you're seeing all the axons that have run in here at postnatal day one. So this is just after birth in the mouse. Over the ensuing week, this is what happens. These axons begin to send out collateral branches. And they do this preferentially in what will be eventually their topographically correct spot. And you can sort of see that here. They start to branch in this region. If they're over here, they branch towards here, and if they're over here, they branch towards here. And if they're up here, they don't really branch very much. And by postnatal day 8, that's refined to this very, very precise zone. So for what I'll tell you about, this is important to keep in mind. It doesn't occur instantly, and it occurs during a period of time when axons are competing with one another for space in this target, right, tissue, in the superior. It does not depend on the light, and to a first approximation, it does not depend on electrical activity. And I'll get back to this, because this is an old issue in the field, as to how much of this refinement of these termination zones is dependent on coordinated visual experience. So one simple model is that neurons that are close together in the retina are going to be seeing the same visual stimulus. So if I'm looking out here, if I'm looking over there, two neighboring neurons are going to basically be seeing the same thing. They're going to have coordinated electrical activity, and that would be a mechanism. And I'm going to show you data which says to a first approximation that is an entirely secondary mechanism. It doesn't really play a prominent role in establishing this topography. It plays a little role, but I don't think it plays an important role. Okay. I'm going to show you experiments that are all in the mouse. So it depends on the kind of creature. You're a binocular creature because your eyes face forward, but the mouse's eyes face like this. And so, in fact, almost all the stuff I'm going to show you is crossing to the contralateral side of the brain because almost all the projections in the mouse from this eye, 95% of them go to the other side of the brain. The lateral geniculate is basically the same thing. So the lateral geniculate as well is almost a complete, a mouse is basically not a binocular creature. So I'm going to address anything related to binocularity today, really only to the topography of this innervation. These guys are pruned back. So this axon that's overshot will eventually be pulled back, and the final termination zone will have been established not by the initial growth cone of the axon, but by these collateral branches. So for those of you who know anything about neurobiology, growth cones are like, you know, a favorite topic for thinking about how axons navigate. The growth cones are very important to getting the axons to the target in the first place, but they're essentially irrelevant to establishing this topography. Yes, yes.
You haven't told us.
I told you. Yeah, so these guys...
That's quite a shock. For those of us who have brought up on growth cones.
Growth cones don't do much. Growth cones are very important to get from the eye across the cone. They're very important to navigate.
And what happens? There are collateral branches.
Yeah.
Little branches come out from the axon.
Yes, yes. Yes, they set up everything. Cell biologically, those collateral branches are no different from growth cones. Growth cones basically directed polymerization of actin, and collateral branches are responding to vector polymerization of actin as well. So I don't think...
So what happens to that original... Sorry, that's the same question. The original growth cone...
You know, you're not paying very close attention. Yes. The original overgrowth is pruned back, so the cell pulls it back.
Oh, it pulls it back.
Yes, it pulls it back over time.
How large?
That's a good question. The time that this is happening... I'm totally bullshitting you here because I don't know the answer to the question, but I'll give you a sort of order of magnitude. A few millimeters. It's not very big. I mean, we can easily visualize this in the mouse. Experimentally, it's very easy because it's on the top of the brain. We just have to cut open the brain and stick this on a microscope slide, and these are fluorescent, so we don't have to do any dissections or anything. This is why people study this projection rather than the projection to the thalamus, to the lateral geniculate, because to see that, you've got to cut the brain open and look at it. Here, we don't have to do any real dissection. Okay, so about 5 years ago, a set of receptor tyrosine kinases and their ligands were implicated in this process. really for two reasons. So the receptors I'm going to talk about today are these things called EPH receptors, and their ligands are molecules called efferents, all right? As I said, you have 58 receptor tyrosine kinases in your genome. 14 of them are in this EPH family. So this is by far the largest family of receptor tyrosine kinases. They come in two flavors, A and B, as do their ligands, efferin A and efferin B. Okay, so for the non-biologists, these are cell surface proteins. They're fixed on the surface of the cell. They act as receptors. The way receptor tyrosine kinases work is they're enzymes. And they are quiescent, or they are inactive, unless this extracellular domain, which is sitting on the surface of the cell, binds its corresponding ligand. The consequence of that for this molecule is that this enzymatic activity is activated, becomes an active tyrosine kinase. That means it phosphorylates proteins on specific tyrosine residues, and it thereby regulates the activity of those downstream proteins. The ligands for these receptors are unusual relative to other receptor tyrosine kinases in that they are absolutely bound to the cell surface. They're not soluble proteins, and they must be bound to the cell surface in order to work. If you express them as cleaved soluble proteins, they're essentially inactive. So they really have to work as dimers or as clusters of proteins in order to activate the receptors. Okay? The ligands come in two flavors. One, the efferent A's are linked to the cell surface by a lipid linkage called a GPI linkage, and the efferent B's are linked to the cell surface by a transmembrane domain. Okay, so they actually go through the membrane. The ones that are important for the system that I'll tell you about today are a subset of the FA's and the efferent A's. And in the mouse, I'm going to talk about these four receptors. FA3, FA4, FA5, FA6, and their two ligands, EphrinA2 and EphrinA5. So this is an evolutionary tree of these receptors, and you'll note that these guys are all basically on the same sub-branch of the FA family, okay? And this is very important for what I'll tell you about. That's consistent with the fact that these receptors bind these two ligands, all of these receptors, bind these two ligands with approximately the same binding affinity, okay? And that's a higher affinity than, for example, these receptors bind those ligands. So this is, for the experimental manipulations I'll tell you about, it's really important to note that FA3, FA6, 5, and 4 all bind and are activated by efferent A2 and A5 approximately equally well. Well, that's the key thing. So the reason these are important in the retinal tectal thing is twofold. One is how they are expressed, okay? The patterns in which they're expressed. So, well, there is redundancy in the receptors, and that's actually the basis of the experiments that I'll tell you about. So these receptors are graded in their distribution, but if you look between species, the actual receptors that make up the gradient switch as you go through evolution. So the chicken uses a different set than the mouse or the human does. All right. So there is redundancy. That's the whole basis of part of the experiment that I'll tell you about. Receptors. Yes. Yes. It's. There are 14 in chicken. There. All right, I'll give you one of these. So these receptors are also very important in patterning in other places. So in development, for example, you have a structure called the neural crest, which is a set of cells that migrate out of the dorsal part of the spinal cord to give rise to the entire peripheral nervous system. All right, those cells always go through the anterior half of each somite, which is a mesodermal structure right next to the developing spinal cord. They always go through the anterior half and never through the posterior half. That's set up by a boundary of two of the efferent B ligands. So in the somites, you have efferent B1 and efferent B2, one of which is expressed throughout the anterior and posterior half, and the other of which is only in the posterior half. Okay, in chicken, it's efferent B1 that's in both places, and efferent B2 that's only in the posterior half. In the mouse, it's efferent B2 that's in both places and efferent B1 that's only in the posterior half. So the particular receptor isn't important. It's the boundary that's important. And that plays out in the business of these FAs as well.
So could you give us an example of what these
things are? Well, that's a very good question. So the question is, how do you measure these affinities? The way they've typically been done is you put the receptors in a cell in culture, and then you put clustered versions of the ligands. What you do is you make the soluble ligand, but it has something stuck onto the C-terminus that allows you to cluster it, physically cluster it with an antibody. When you do those kinds of manipulations, the typical affinities are on the order of 10 to the minus. The KDs, measured KDs, are on the order of 10 to the minus 9 molar, which is 10 to the minus 9, 10 to the minus 10. That's a typical KD for a receptor tyrosine kinase ligand interaction. So they're quite high affinity interactions. But it's a bit problematic. I think two things make this problematic. One is, how do you measure what's the actual affinity for something which is seen by the receptor that's clustered on the surface of the cell? And the other thing that's also not well studied in this system is the extent to which these receptors heterodimerize. And if you have all receptor tyrosine kinases typically work as dimers, right? They don't bind these ligands as monomers, they bind them as dimers. And in many other systems, the dimer can actually be a heterodimer between two closely related proteins. So for example, between FA4 and FA5. And that's not well studied in this system. But in terms of the manipulations I told you, if you do each of that kind of single thing with things in cells, these guys all have binding KDs on the order of 10 to the minus 9 molar. All right, so their distribution in the retina, and you won't be able to see this really well, but I'll show you schematics of this. These are mouse retinas, and what you're looking at are in situ hybridizations for the mRNAs for these receptors. And the positive signal is pink. And these are sections of retina sort of cut in this plane. So we're sampling from nasal to temporal side. And the cells that are relevant for the connection to the brain are so-called retinal ganglion cells, RGCs. These are the only neurons in your eye. They're the output neurons from your eye. They're the only things that are, to a first approximation, that are connected to the brain. And in this kind of section, the RGC layer is this skinny little layer of cells here on the inside. And you can't see it, so just take my word for it. In the mouse, the two graded receptors are FA5 and FA6. So FA5, for example, is at very, very low levels on the nasal side of the retina. And as you move over to the temporal side of the retina, this level increases. This is the relevant signal here. This stuff is in. These cells will become the inner cell layer of the eye, and they are not connected to the brain. So this signal is irrelevant. It's only this signal here. That's FA5. FA6 shows basically a very similar pattern. Very low levels on the nasal side. As you move to the temporal side, it increases.
So are you saying that FA6 is not expressed in the neuroblast layer?
Right.
FA5?
Right, exactly. There's an additional receptor which isn't on this slide, which is FA4, which is also expressed in the retinal ganglion cell layer, okay, but which is ungraded. So it's constant across the nasal temporal axis. All right. FA3, which we'll use, which binds these ligands with the same affinity, is actually not expressed in the mouse in the retinal ganglion cell layer at all. So all this expression you actually see is in these developing internuclear layers. Okay? So these guys, the retinal ganglion cells, do not express FA3. I'll get back to this gene in just a second. This is a gene which is not a receptor at all. It codes a transcription factor called islet-2. And what you can see is that it's also expressed in this retinal ganglion cell layer. It is not graded across the nasal temporal axis. But if you look at this carefully, you see it's kind of a spotty signal. And what I'll tell you, I won't show you much data for this, but we've looked at this in great detail. In fact, this is the key thing for doing the experimental manipulation. This gene is, to a first approximation, expressed in every other retinal ganglion cell. Every other. So it's on, off, on, off, on, off, on, off. Yes, FA6 and FA5 are expressed in the same cells, and as far as we can tell, they're expressed in every retinal ganglion cell.
Can you test the gradient? Just take us along a gradient.
Sure. Well, you can't see it, Lewis.
Just take us along. Just go.
So what I'm talking about is this. Let me see which. If you can just barely. This is a DAPI stain, so this blue is actually seeing the nuclei. So this is the layer I'm talking about. There's no gradient here, okay? So this is the layer we're talking about.
And that's a single layer of.
It's a single layer of cell. Sometimes there's two piled up, but basically it's one layer of cell. So here you can see there's no signal, right? This is FA5. Now it's going up, 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 up. This section actually isn't cut exactly right. So a lot of this stuff, physicists won't really appreciate it, but it comes down to trivial things. You've got to have the eye oriented exactly right when you've cut the section. This one's not exactly right. But you see the basic idea is there's very little here. It goes up and up and up and up, and there's the most is over here on the temporal side, right? And we're not the only ones who've done this. This has been analyzed out the wazoo, so there's no question about it by multiple laboratories, including John Flanagan's lab at Harvard, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So,
when you say every other ganglion cell has
expressed
this
islet? Yeah,
islet 2,
yes?
What do you mean by that? That if you go in every direction, it'll be on here, and then it'll be on.
Right. I might have a picture of that here.
And it doesn't matter what class of ganglion cells?
They are different. Well, it very well may matter what difference. So what he's referring to is that ganglion cells are physiologically different in terms of their response properties. But we don't care about any of that. All we care about is topography of where they're located. So they could very well be physiologically distinct. We don't know that. It's possible. But it's irrelevant for what I'm going to tell you.
Are there in there?
It's pretty much speckled. I mean, we've looked at this pretty. It's pretty much 50% of the retinal ganglion cells, evenly distributed all across both axes.
Is this determined in the adult or in the newborn?
It's determined in the newborn. So this is a postnatal day zero animal. Okay, you can sort of tell it's because the first cell types differentiate the retinal ganglion cells. Most of the retina, rest of the retina has not differentiated at this point. These cells actually are the first cells to differentiate in the retinal ganglion cell. And the thing that I'm talking about occurs in a mouse in the first postnatal week. So that's why we're measuring these at postnatal days zero.
So given that layer has displaced amacrine cells, the number of comparable to the ganglion.
Sound like an expert here, yes.
What's the basis for saying that this is labeling two different, it's labeling
right. So,
one set of ganglion and not another set of ganglion, maybe ganglion.
Right, so there are, this is a sophisticated question. Not all of the cells in the retinal ganglion cell layer are retinal ganglion cells. Some of them are so-called displaced amacrine cells. They're cells which really should be up here in terms of physiology, but have made their way into the retinal ganglion cell layer. So we've quantitated this in detail, and this is actually published. The number of cells which are actually positive for islet-2 in the retinal ganglion cell layer is 20%. Not 50%. And those cells are also independently positive for other retinal ganglion cell markers. And since displaced amacrine cells in this layer actually make up about 60% of the cells in the mouse, that's how we come up with this number that 50% of the retinal ganglion cells are positive. You're right.
Okay.
I took most of these out because this is.
You never find either two expressed in two adjacencies.
No, you sometimes see it in two. I'm saying you do sometimes see it in two adjacencies. I said to a first approximation. It's not as the spacing is not as precise, for example, as lateral inhibition or something of the dress. No, it's not that fine. You just see this sort of. I'll show you. I think I have some more slides.
Doesn't matter.
But you do sometimes see two adjacent cells that are either two positive. Yes. Islet-2 is a nuclear protein. It's a transcription factor, a limb homeodomain transcription factor. And I'll tell you, the reason we use it, God, that's a weird anomaly. Did you just hear that? It's like the microphone was like doing something with this. So two reasons why these EPH receptors are important. One is the distribution, okay? So that if you, both the ligands and the receptors, if you look at this distribution that comes out like this, so I just showed you the receptors. It turns out the ligands are also graded. So the receptors go from low nasally to high temporally. And for mouse, this is FA5 and FA6. And in addition, there is this one receptor, FA4, which is ungraded. And in the target, the ligands are graded. So the ligands together, EphrinA2 and EphrinA5 together, make up a grading that goes from low rostrally to high caudally. All right? So Sperry, in formulating this chemoaffinity hypothesis, had a model which was basically based on complementary ligands and gradient receptors, which would give you specific addresses from here to here along this axis. And the reason these receptors and ligands were so compelling was not only this distribution, but the bioactivity that's measured of the ligand. So this was done by a bunch of people, by Friedrich Bonhoeffer and his colleagues in Tübingen, by John Flanagan and his colleagues at Harvard, and by my colleague Dennis O'Leary at the Salk. And all of that work together have basically showed that these ligands are so-called chemorepellents for neurons that express the receptors. So if you're a neuron and you have one of these receptors and you've sent out a growth cone and you contact a surface that has the ligand, the response that you have is to bundle all the axons in your growth cone, to collapse the growth cone, to depolymerize actin and to retract your process. Okay? So they're so-called chemorepellents for that reason. Neurons that have the receptors don't like to grow on surfaces that have these ligands. And if you keep that bioactivity in mind together with this mapping, this makes perfect sense then. You have a circumstance where these guys that have very low levels of the receptor and are presumably not, therefore, particularly sensitive to these ligands, grow all the way back to the target where the ligands are highest, presumably because they can stand it, right? Whereas these guys that have very high levels of the receptor, they're exquisitely sensitive to the ligand, they can't stand, they really hate everything, and they grow down here to where this, they end up here where the ligand concentrations are lowest. And if you're in between, you end up someplace in between. Okay, so if you're here, you end up about here. All right. So that was a model about 5 years ago, no longer. Question is, how do you test this, right? This is an unusual model in biology in that it's not a qualitative on-off model. It's not like you're something because you express this protein or you're not because you don't express this protein. It's based on the graded distribution of signaling molecules, right? So the first approach to any biologist to ask whether these things are working this way is to make a mutant where you take the things away, right? But that's only satisfactory at one level, right? That's only going to give you a qualitative answer to this problem. So that, in fact, has been done in this system. In the mouse, there is a double knockout for EphrinA2 and EphrinA5, right? Take away, and we know those are the only two ligands. You take everything away. What happens, okay? You lose basically all features of topography. Now the neurons, a neuron, say here, projects all over this rostral caudal axis. It projects to multiple termination zones. Almost all features of topography are lost. All right. So that tells you qualitatively that the system is important, right? That these receptors and ligands are actually used. But it doesn't tell you that mechanistically it's working in the way you think it is, right? So in order to test that, you really have to make some perturbation to the system, which changes the properties of these gradients, which changes their slope, or changes their orientation, or changes their periodicity. You have to, in such that you can make informative predictions. And we found a way to do this using that islet 2 gene, all right? Because my colleague Sam Pfaff had been studying islet 2, because he studies it in motor neuron differentiation in the spinal cord, and he's the one who initially made these observations in the retina. So, and the way he did this was not by doing the in situ I showed you earlier. He made a mouse in which he stuck a marker into the 3' untranslated region of the islet 2 gene. So I'll just go over this for non-biologists because it's a little bit complicated. It's sort of a fancy business. This is the islet 2 gene. This marker is something called tau-laxy. It's an enzymatic marker that will turn things blue, and it's fused to a protein called tau, which is incorporated into microtubules. And microtubules go down the shafts of axons, so it allows you to visualize axons directly. And this is driven by something called an internal ribosome entry site. So basically what you make in this construct is a bicistronic messenger RNA. You make both islet 2, and wherever islet 2 is expressed, you're also going to make tau-laxy, because this thing is under the control of all the regulatory elements that control the cell-specific expression of islet 2. Okay? And this is done in embryonic stem cells. So you take this construct, you put this thing, and you replace the endogenous islet 2 locus with this DNA, and then you make a mouse from those cells where you've had this homologous recombinant. And when you make this mouse and you look to see where tau-laxy is expressed, Sam did this, it's expressed in all the places that he knew islet 2 was normally expressed. So islet 2 is expressed in motor neurons in the ventral spinal cord. It's expressed in sensory neurons of the dorsal root ganglion right outside the spinal cord. And you see it's also labeling all the axons that come from these structures. But in addition to those places, he also found it in the retina. So here's a picture. This is now a flat mount of a retina. So you take a retina out. This is about postnatal day 0, I think. In order to make it stay flat on the slide, you put a set of cuts in so you get the sort of clover leaf shape. And this is the sort of speckling pattern I was telling you about. Okay, so these are all the islet 2 positive cells, and all of their axons, which are running here to the optic disc, which is the place where all the axons leave the eye, are all labeled. Okay, so you see, just as sort of a gestalt first pass, you see this sort of speckling kind of pattern. This stuff you're seeing is in the microtubules of the axons that are leaving the eye, right? And it's in the microtubules of the cell bodies, which are here all over the place. So you see the signals, the speckling signals, sort of all over the eye. There's really not much gradation you can see if you look at it. In fact, there's really not. There's a slight, in the extreme ventral temporal retina, there's a slight reduction of expression. But overall, basically you see it's all over the place. Yes. Yeah, I'm not really sure about that, but I don't even know for sure the orientation of these things. Most of the time when I'll show you some retinal flat mounts, the orientation will be dorsal up and ventral down, and I think nasal on this side and temporal on this side.
So that lower density in the lower left.
This guy, yeah, I think this is probably I think this is ventral temporal, yeah. Almost all the analysis I'm going to show you actually excludes this area, so it's not really a complication for us. Let me just show you a higher power in situ. I think this is in the next slide. So basically what we did is we took that construct, okay, and we took out tau-lax-Z and replaced tau-lax-Z with an FA3 cDNA, all right? So it's basically exactly the same construct, but it has FA3 in this thing now. Now, so the point of this is, remember, FA3 is not expressed in the mouse retinal ganglion cells, but it binds the same ligands, right? So the idea for this manipulation, and we're going to make a mouse from this. We made mice from this, right? This will be in all the islet 2 positive cells. No, it won't be in the microtubules because we don't have tau tied to it. Lax-Z was in the microtubules because it was actually not Lax-Z, it was tau-Lax-Z. It had tau-like fused protein. It won't go to the same place as tau-laxy. It will go to the cell surface. It will go where EPH receptors normally go. We don't want it to go to the same place. We just want it to be in the same cells. Subcellularly, we don't want it to be in the axon. Well, we don't want it to be inside the cell. We want it to be on the cell surface where normal EPH receptors are. So we made that mouse. And here are some in situs which basically show that the manipulation worked. So these are now high-powered pictures of the retina. So these are like higher power sections of the same things I showed you before. This is islet 2 at postnatal day 0, when the retinal ganglion cell layer is not really well defined. You see it's sort of, you know, on some cells. The thing is anywhere from 1 to 2 cell layers deep. By postnatal day 12, when the layer is much better resolved, this is the sort of pattern you see at high power for islet 2. Here's a positive cell, bunch of negative cells, positive cell, negative cell, positive cell, positive cell, 3 negative cells, positive. So it's sort of onish, 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 onish. This is very... Some of these are amacrine cells. And when you go through and count these all up, as I said, and you do a DAPI stain, this signal accounts for 20% of the cells. We've co-stained with other retinal ganglion cell markers, so we know these are retinal ganglion cells, and since it's 20% of 40 of the 40% cells that are RGCs, that's how we get 50% of the cells. So this is, again, that islet 2 signal at a slightly lower power now, in postnatal day 0 in a wild type mouse. It's just a normal mouse, it's this spotty signal here. Okay, and here again is the FA3 signal in that same normal wild type mouse at postnatal day 0. It's in this inner layer, but it's not in the retinal ganglion cell layers. So the key thing here is this panel down here. This is FA3 mRNA, the same mRNA, but in an animal which is homozygous for that knock-in construct. So in addition to this signal here, you also now see this signal for FA3, which looks just like the signal for islet 2. So basically, amazing enough, the experimental manipulation worked in the way that we thought it would. And the key also for what I'm going to tell you about is we know this gene, islet 2, is not expressed in the target. So it's only expressed here in the retina in this system that we're studying. So that's a key manip. So we're not putting receptors into the target. So what does that allow us to do? Basically, that allows us to change the normal distribution of receptors and ligands in the gradient from something in the retina, from something that looks like this. Actually, could you just push when I need it so I don't have people. It's this thing. I'll cue you. So it changes us from something that looked like this, where we have a constant level of FA4 across the nasal temporal axis. I'm going to show you a bunch of graphs now in subsequent slides where this axis is nasal temporal axis of the retina, and nasal is arbitrarily defined as 0 and temporal is arbitrarily defined as 100%. So the normal gradient looks something like this. You've got constant FA4, and then you've got a gradient that of FA5 and FA6, which together make this up. And that's what it is in wild type. That allows us to go in heterozygous. We've changed this gradient from one which is smoothly increasing to one which oscillates wildly, because we've stuck these spikes of knocked-in FA3 on top of this gradient. And we can go actually, this is an animal which only has one copy of this allele. If we go to the next slide, is animal which has two copies of these spikes are going to be twice as high. All right? So if you think about it, this is exactly the kind of manipulation you need to quantitatively test this model. And if you have a gradient like this, what are the predictions for how this is going to affect the topography? All right? So we analyze this topography always by doing anatomical manipulations. And in the next slide, I'll show you basically how this works and what the prediction is. Yeah, go ahead. Yes. No, that's very, very often the case for these guys. So, for example, several of these receptors have been knocked out. And if you look at the levels of RNA and protein in heterozygous knockouts versus homozygous knockouts, there's twice as much. And we've actually, I didn't show you the data for that because this is published data, but we've actually looked at that. And in fact, you can actually measure this. And I will show you quantitation of this later, that there actually is twice as much in the knock-in. We did not quantify the protein. The problem, and I'll get into this, is a very important point. Ideally, you would like to quantify the protein. But the problem is we actually have to quantify each of the proteins because the gradient is not a single receptor. It's made up of two receptors, okay? If we were just measuring one receptor, we could measure the protein, but because there are antibodies for these things. The problem is really that you need antibodies which are specific for each of the receptors, FA3, FA4, FA5, and FA6. Which don't recognize the other one. So that, you know, the signal you're seeing is only for that receptor. But much more importantly, each of those antibodies has to bind to the receptor with the same affinity. Otherwise, your relative quantitation is irrelevant, right? So you don't actually need to know how much protein is there. You need to know how much protein, how much FA4 is there relative to FA5, relative to FA3, relative to FA6. And we can't do that with protein, but we can do it with RNA. But you've got to... But you're going to be doing this with antibodies, right? So you need an antibody. Sure. No, it's not theoretically impossible. It's not so much the question of the antibody behind it. All the antibodies' affinities have to be the same, right? Oh yeah, if they're ideally high, right? But we don't. I mean, we don't have those things. That's for right now. That's sort of pie in the sky. Whereas we can reproducibly quantitate RNAs, and I'll get into this in a bit. But so anyway, what's the prediction for what this map should look like? So we look at this anatomically, right? And the way we're going to do this is to inject focally globs of a lipophilic tracer called DII into the retina. This thing partitions into the membrane. This is an intensely fluorescent dye. It's lipophilic. So it diffuses down the plane of the membrane and allows us to visualize where the termination zones are. That's what that black and white image I showed you in the second slide was. So if you, what's the prediction? If you do this kind of thing in a wild-type retina, in the extreme nasal retina, the prediction is, because of the mapping, that you should label a single termination zone all the way back in the extreme caudal end of the colliculus of the target. You do this same manipulation now into the knock-in retina. Because this is an extracellular injection, you're not putting this inside a cell. You're putting a crystal of this stuff into the retina. It's sometimes going to be a quite big crystal. You're always, because of the nature of the induced expression, going to be hitting an expressing and a non-expressing cell. Okay? So you do this into the nasal version of the knock-in retina. Now you should label one termination zone in the same place in the contralateral colliculus. That corresponds to the neuron which is not expressing the knocked-in allele, knocked-in gene. And you also should label a second termination zone, which is shifted rostrally along this map because it now has higher levels of the receptor. It is more sensitive, in theory, to the chemorepellent, and it should terminate, therefore, more rostrally in this thing. Okay? That's the prediction. And the size of this shift should be, in fact, a function of the genotype, the level of the knock-in allele. This shift should be wider in homozygous knock-ins than it should be in heterozygous knock-ins. So we tested all those things.
Because there's a distribution of the ligand.
There's a distribution of the ligand as well. And in the heterozygotes, they're going to have less receptors. So they're not going to be as sensitive, right? That's the theory, right? Turns out that that's true. And I'll show you just a quick set of data for this. So what you're looking at now are the results of these injections. These are diagrams of what the retina looks like. This is the place we stuck the DII, okay? And then this is the colliculus that's attached to that retina. So you can't really see this, but this is basically the entire colliculus here. This is its rostral end. This is its caudal end. This is at the midline of the brain, so this would be the medial side, and this is the lateral side near the side of the brain. So those are the two axes, and we're only going to be talking about this axis. So you do this injection in a wild-type guy, right? You get a single termination zone back here in this caudal end, right? You do this in a heterozygous knock, and now instead of one termination zone, you get two, right? One which is shifted rostrally along this axis relative to this guy. You do the same experiment in a homozygous knock-in, and don't be confused here, they're just two colors because we did two separate injections right next to one another. Just look at the red things. Again, we get two termination zones rather than one, and now the magnitude of the shift from between these two termination zones is actually greater than it is in the heterozygotes. Okay? So we quantitated this. We did injections all along this nasal temporal axis. And what we plotted was the position of the injection site relative to the center of the termination zone along this rostral caudal axis for each of these three genotypes, right? And so that allowed us to plot out these simple mapping functions in these three genotypes, okay? Is there another gradient of, you mean? Oh, a gradient going this direction. Not as far as we can tell. Earlier, that's the end of, I'll tell you about that at the end of the talk. That's because that's very important. And it's something that Lewis loves to hear about. Yes, we know a little bit about that. Yeah.
Are there knockouts of ligands?
There are knockouts, yes. There are individual knockouts of both EphrinA2 and EphrinA5. And there are double knockouts where you take away everything. That's what I was referring to earlier. when you take away all the ligands, the axons don't know where they go. So they project it to multiple places, and many of those places are incorrect.
So I guess I don't quite understand something about the model. Mm-hmm. So there is a gradient of chemorepellent, but the assumption is that unless axon is growth hormone is repelled, it's going to go as far as it can go.
Right, there's something drawing it into the target in the first place, right?
That's right. So if that's the case, you think that you knock out this ligand, and whatever has been pushing the temporal or nasal things to go as far as they can.
They should just go as far as they can.
Why don't temporal project into hormone region?
Sure. That's a very good point. I mean, if you think about it, according to the model is, if none of these guys like the ligands anyway, why don't they all end up at the very rostral end of the target where the ligands are lowest? Okay? Both of those things speak to the issue of competition, that there's something limiting with regard to the target for retinal ganglion cell axons. And I'll talk some more about this. We actually have a really good idea. But you're right. Both of those things are correct. There's something pulling them in. Why? And you take away all the chemorepellent. Why don't they all go to the end? But similarly, in the normal system, why don't they all grow to the front? Right? Because nobody likes these ligands. It's just that the temporal guys like them less. Right? And we have an explanation for that. But let me get to that. Okay? All right. So let's just go over these mapping functions because they're very important for the rest of the talk. So the next slide is this is the mapping function in a wild-type animal. So I'll show you several plots like this. Again, the x-axis here is just that. The position where we did the injection in the retina from 0 to 100 with nasal being 0 and temporal being 100. And this acts as the position of the termination, the center of the termination zone in the target along the rostral caudal axis. So this we're only talking about the rostral caudal axis here. There's no information about the other axis. So it's an amazingly linear function. So each one of these points corresponds to a different mouse where we did this experiment. And sure enough, if you're in the extreme nasal retina, you project all the way back to the caudal end of the colliculus. If you're in the middle, you project to the middle of this axis. And if you're at the temporal end, you project all the way to the front.
Just a technical question. These are injections in the living animal or implants? They're
injections into a living animal. The injections are done at a time in a mouse when this map is normally mature, which is about we usually do these at postnatal day 10. So it takes a day for the dye to diffuse. So we do the injection, keep the animal alive for a day, sacrifice the animal, and then open the brain and look to see where the termination zone is.
It's not a crystalline implant. It's a solution that you're injecting. It's being physiologically taken up by the cells rather than by damaged membrane.
Exactly. Exactly.
What's the density of neurons in the nasotemporal axis? So why should it be linear, not just monotonic?
That's a very good question. We were actually surprised at this because in higher visual areas, the overall density is approximately equivalent until you get right at the fovea. The fovea is the area right around where the optic nerve leaves the eye, and then the density of neurons gets much, much higher. And we actually, in visual cortex, for example, you look to see how visual space is mapped onto the visual cortex. The fovea is overrepresented, so there would be a bulge in this. And so we were surprised at this extreme linearity, but nonetheless, that's what we measure. So you actually use almost all of your vision. Yes, I'm looking at you now, and I'm actually seeing very, very little because almost everything is concentrated around the center of the eye. And so we were surprised to see it. So the density is high of cells, of all cells in the retina, is higher at the center than it is. But we've tended to ignore that. That will be a complication for some of the quantitation I show you later. So that's wild type. That's basically what the normal function. In the heterozygous knock-in, go ahead, you get this function. Now, this function, these curves will be very important for the rest of the talk, so you've got to keep these in mind. So what you have here, basically, in this mouse is that for the first 75% or so of the nasal temporal axis, so from about here to here, every point, to first approximation, every point in space is duplicated in the target. So these two points correspond to a single injection. These two points from a single injection. These two points are from a single injection. These two points are from a single injection. Those two points are from a single injection. So every point along this axis is mapped to two places in the target until you get to 75, it's actually measured at 76% now of this axis. Okay? And from that point, then this duplicated map suddenly collapses to a single coherent map. And this part of the extreme temporal retina Now it's just, it's almost like wild type. This is the wild type. This dotted line is the wild type curve here. Right? So we thought something like this might happen in these guys, because even though we know now that we've knocked in a constant amount, because the other two expression level in the cells that are expressing is constant across this axis, we've knocked in a constant amount, right? However, that constant amount of knocked in allele of FA3, and I didn't say this, but this is very important for the analysis. Basically, for what I'm telling you about today, you can consider FA3, FA4, FA5, and FA6 equivalent. Right, so we're talking about changing the net FA gradient, okay? I said that, but I should emphasize it. So we're knocking a constant amount of FA3 in, but that constant amount is riding on a gradient which is increasing. So the relative difference between an expressing and a non-expressing cell in this part of the gradient is much less than the relative difference of an expressing cell and a non-expressing cell in this part of the gradient, right? So we thought the two curves might gradually come together. But in fact, they don't gradually come together. They come together suddenly.
One of those curves should be wild type.
One of those curves should be wild type. And neither of those curves is wild type. This phenotype is even more dramatic in the homozygote, which is seen in the next slide. That's a key point. All right? So this is the homozygous mapping function. And the homozygous mapping function, the map is duplicated throughout the axis. So for this guy, every point in visual space is represented as two points in visual space in the clicker. And the key thing is exactly what you said. Neither of these maps is wild type. All right? We've only changed gene expression in half the cells. Right? This is the wild type map. All right, so look at this map carefully. There are a couple things which are just totally wild about this map. One is that this issue that I just mentioned, right? That neither of these maps is normal. If you look at this carefully, you might guess that this map corresponds to the guys that are expressing the knocked-in gene, because it's mapping to this front end of the colliculus where the ligands are lowest, right? And similarly, this map should be the wild-type map because it's mapping back to where the ligands are highest. These guys should have the normal levels of receptors, but these guys here should be mapping down here. Instead, they're mapping back here. It's almost as if they have been pushed back to this part of the target by the preferential occupation of this target by these neurons in this map. And that argues for this issue of competition, right, which you mentioned earlier, right, about the normal growing. Yes?
Have you done the reverse experiment? If you inject in the superior colliculus, you retrograde the label of the retina.
Yeah, we have. I'll show you that in a second.
Basically. And then verify that the cells were in one focus.
We did. That's the experiment I'll tell you about now. So. That's a key issue. We got to really decide what these two genotypes are, and we did do that. Let's just go straight to that. So this is the next slide. So you can, instead of putting a tracer in the eye, which goes forward and labels the target labels cells in the target, you can put a retrograde tracer in the target, okay, which is picked up by cells in the target and then goes back to the cells, the retinal ganglion cells that are projected to that place, okay. So. And these things are actually now not dyes. They're small latex spheres called microspheres that can be fluorescently labeled to a bunch of different colors. They're actually taken up by cells and then intracellularly labeled. So we did this experiment, and we did this in the homozygote. So if our model is correct, we should actually be able to predict where those sites are by just taking the x-axis intercepts from each of these curves, right? So we did this experiment. This is where we injected these things along the rostral caudal axis of the superior colliculus. We did one thing with some green spheres and one thing with some red spheres. The green spheres are at about 60%, just under 60% of this rostral caudal axis. And you take this over, that's predicted to nick this lower curve and retrogradely label one field in the extreme nasal retina and another field at about 60% of the nasal temporal axis. And then we did an injection of some red spheres down here just under 30%, which won't hit the upper curve, will only hit the lower curve, giving us a single thing in about the same position. All right? This is the retina which is connected to that superior colliculus. Okay? And if you look at this, this is the nasal temporal axis. Here's the green field. Boom, corresponds to this guy. Here is this field, corresponds to this guy. And this is amazing. And this is this red field corresponds exactly to this. So the predictions are held exactly. And I can still remember when I pulled this thing off the color printer, which is, some of you may know Chuck Stevens, it was outside Chuck Stevens' office, and I was just flabbergasted by this result. And, you know, I showed it to Chuck, and Chuck said, well, I mean, what's the big deal? It's exactly as predicted by your curves. I said, Chuck, this is biology. Things never work out like this, all right? So we used this technique then to address your question, which is in the next slide. So we did an injection right smack in the middle of the rostral caudal axis. That's predicted to hit both of those curves. Remember, the nasal curve, the nasal field that's done from that injection is the lower curve, so this should be the Nocton allele. The temporal field is from hitting the upper curve, okay? So, and sure enough, we do this, we do get two fields. You can just barely see it. This is the nasal side and the temporal side. We've got a nasal field and a temporal field, all right? So, first of all, think about that, what this mouse is doing. It's looking at the visual world. It's got visual space over here and visual space over here, completely opposite ends of the visual, of this spectrum. And it's putting that information into the same place in the colliculus, right? Because we've done a single label here, and we've retrograded the label to retinal ganglion cell fields, right? Of course, the argument I'm going to make is it's doing that only because it's expressing the same level of net level of EPH receptors, right? Those two cells are going to see completely different patterns of electrical activity, both with regard to visual space and with regard to spontaneous activity that's moving as waves across the retina. So electrical activity is not controlling this topography at all. This phenomenon is completely dominant.
So how do you know they're seeing the same visual space? I mean, your mouse is moving around and looking.
Well, actually, they're moving, well, but at any given time, right, you know, they are moving around, but at any given time when their eye is looking out, this part of the retina is seeing completely different stuff from this part of it. It doesn't make any difference how fast they're moving. But for the point of this argument, in fact, the eyes are actually, this is before the time the mouse actually opens the eyes. So the only thing that's controlling coordinated activity are actually these wave, calcium waves that move across the retina as waves. And there, clearly, cells that are next to one another are seeing these waves at temporally different times. So that temporal coordination has nothing to do with this topography. Zero. I mean, we can completely override this by just changing EPH receptor levels expression. I mean, this was a very controversial thing for the field because there's a lot of literature in developing neurobiology about this stuff. But it's mostly experimental manipulations that have lots of problems. Anyway, to get to your issue, so we got a nasal field here and a temporal field now. We cut these out, and we do an in situ for the gene that we've knocked in. And this is the result. So you're looking at very high power here. This is a layer of retinal ganglion cells. You can just sort of barely make these cells out. In the nasal field, the cells which are positive for FA3 are also positive for the beads that we injected into the colliculus. And similarly, the bead-positive cells are positive for FA3. Whereas in the temporal field, it's completely the opposite. All of the bead-positive cells are FA3 negative. And all the FA3-positive cells are bead-negative, right? And we quantitated this for hundreds of cells. So it's sort of an indirect measure, but basically I think it's a pretty compelling argument that essentially that entire lower curve does correspond to the guys that are expressing the Nocton allele, okay? I'll show you some direct data for that at the very end. So in the next slide, just to summarize this, I call this sort of beating a dead horse, but if you think about this, two retinal ganglion cells, which are in approximately the same position on the nasal temporal axis of the retina, will map to two completely different places in the colliculus if they express different levels of EPH receptors. Similarly, the very same point in the colliculus will receive information from two completely different points in the retina if those retinal points express the same level of EPH receptors. All right? And there were a number of conclusions from this analysis at this point. One of the most important ones was that during this period of competition, because of this phenomena and other phenomena, that cells along this axis were sorting themselves out in the target by comparing themselves one to another, their EPH receptor levels, not in terms of an absolute difference in their receptor levels, but rather in terms of a relative difference. That the cells basically during this period of competition and sorting out, we're calculating a ratio. It was sort of a probabilistic argument, rather than taking a difference, rather than performing subtraction. All right. Now, if that is true, I think in the next slide, if that aspect is true in normal development, then one feature of this diagram of the gradient has to be wrong. This was actually originally pointed out to me by Chuck Stevens. And that is that the gradient's a straight line. That schematic has to be wrong if cells are taking a ratio.
More or
sure.
taking the, they're comparing what? Are they there? Here are two cells.
What I'm saying is, let's say you and I are along the nasal temporal axis of the retina. And let's say you are temporal and I'm nasal. And let's say you have 14 EPH receptors and I have 7. During this, the interpretation is that when we are trying to decide how we are going to map, okay, I don't compare myself to you by saying you have 7 more receptors than I do. I compare myself to you by saying you have twice as many receptors as I do. And that within certain limits, and we know what those limits are, that it doesn't make any difference whether it's 14 to 7 or 20 to 10 or 22 to 11. It's the ratio that's important. Cells do this during competition. I'll get to this in the end. They do this by competing as when they're doing for this in this branching thing for competing levels of a neurotrophic factor which is actually inducing the branches in the first place. That's a neurotrophic factor called BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor. That's the model we have right now. So, as Chuck pointed out, the gradient can't be a straight line, right? If you think of it, the simplest straight line, y equals x, for percentage change from 20 to 40, say, right? That's a twofold change if your slope is 1. A percentage change from 80 to 100, which is the same distance, it's only a 1.25-fold change if your slope is 1. So you can't have a straight line. Instead, next slide, the rate of change of the FA concentration as a function of where you are on this axis, that must be proportional to the concentration itself. Okay? That's the only, if this model is correct and it operates in normal development, right? So that's the world's simplest differential equation. If you solve that differential equation, next slide, you of course get, if we solve it for C, of course you get, the gradient should be an exponential, right? And since we know that one of the receptors in this distribution is FA4, is there at a constant level, the actual shape of the gradient should be an exponential, next slide, plus a constant that reflects that constant level of FA4 expression, okay? So we've measured this, okay, for each of the receptors, which is in the next slide. We've done in situ hybridizations. I won't go into the details because it's important, but it's complicated. We actually measured mRNA levels at 20 different points along the nasal temporal axis for each of the receptors that make up the net FA receptor gradient. Okay. And this is done basically by doing titered in situ hybridizations over a range of probes with probes that are the same length, labeled to the same specific activity, made to the same region of the receptor, hybridized to the same sections, exposed for the same amount of time. So the absolute levels of these things are not important. What's important is that these are hard numbers for relative levels of expression of FA4, FA5, and FA6. So this is the distribution for each of those receptors, right? And if we add these things up, we get this net distribution for FA in the retina, all right? This wobble here in the center, I think you can ignore because of this issue about the concentration of cells in the fovea being, and this induces all kinds of artifacts in terms of distorting the layer and quantity. We tried to take care of this, but it's very, very hard. So this sort of wiggliness I don't think is significant at all. But if you just look at this curve, it's extremely shallow in the nasal part of the retina, and it's quite steep in the temporal part. There's no way you're going to model this well by a straight line. But in fact, you can model it beautifully, next slide, by an exponential of exactly the form that I told you. So these are the points from that previous curve for the net FA level, all right? And this is, I just did this on Kaleidograph by plugging in various constants, and you see you get this beautiful fit. I mean, it's an amazingly good fit. E to the 0.02x plus 2.6, all right? Now, I didn't point this out in the previous slide, but 2.6 is, in fact, the measured level of FA4. And if you remember, I don't remember how to do this. This level is actually FA4. So this constant even agrees perfectly. All right? Question?
The ratio of exponential plus the constant doesn't tell you either.
Why not?
It doesn't give you linear.
We don't want linear. Why do we want linear? We only want linear in the end. I'll get back to this. That's not what. This is. Okay.
Receptor that's making up this total has the same exponential that sum to give this exponential?
Well, I didn't. We haven't modeled the individual ones. I wouldn't say that.
But they have to. It comes up.
Yes. Okay. So I actually haven't looked at it, but I can. Yeah.
So is that size? But then is that length? And it's a percentage. How much is the distribution of retina sizes?
The retinas are all the same. So we've done all this quantitation in the same, I'm not quite sure I understand, the same postnatal day age, so the retinas are basically all the same. You mean the distribution of the samples we're taking? We're doing this quantitation basically, I didn't want to get into this, but we're doing this quantitation essentially only on the middle third of the retina, because when you get to the extreme top ends, it gets very hard to define, you know, the parameters of the axis. So all this measurement, basically what we've done is we've cut sections essentially in the very center of the retina, where the lens is, okay? And then we have sampled by drawing, using NIH image to quantitate, basically to count silver grain counts, all along this axis from the extreme nasal side to the extreme temporal side in 20 individual increments. So those points are actually averages over 5% of the axis. We don't have to know, because we know one of the gradient. We know one of the things is not graded. We could, but we don't. We know we have to add a constant, because one of the aspects we have to basically sit. This is going to be important for the analysis. We basically have to have the exponential sit on a plinth or sit on a platform. I'll get to that. First of all, we know that this constant level of receptor, this added constant, is a feature in all maps. So if you look in all species, in chickens and amphibians and frogs, you always see this constant thing.
I'm not saying that there is not a constant, that this constant could be part of the competition.
Could multiply, yeah.
It could be part of the competition.
I could try that. I didn't try. It might very well be. The reason I put the constant on this is in part because of a ratioing thing. See, if you don't have a constant added to this equation and you're taking a difference across the whole range, then when you get to the operating range of the ratio becomes very, very large, right? So in the nasal retina, you're dividing by a very, very small number, and you're asking the biology basically to operate over very large ranges of ratios, whereas here you don't. Right. Well, no, that doesn't say that A4 is not working in the competition. It says A4 could very well work in the competition. It's just that all we're saying is there's no difference between A4, A3, A5, and A6. They're all FA.
That's technical.
You still haven't got the model. Yeah, so let me just go on. Let me go on with this math, and then you can... So. With this curve, we've measured the levels of FA3 in the islet 2 noctin. So this is the amount of FA3 we've knocked in the homozygotes, which is this slide, and in the heterozygotes, which is the next slide. And you can see that, sure enough, this level is relatively constant, as we thought just by looking at it. There's maybe a slight rise in the temporal retina, but basically this is a constant thing. So if we now superimpose these spikes on top of that exponential I showed you before, this is what the model of what the actual gradient would look like. Okay? Now, this is, we know in the thing, is a discontinuous function. It really is like this. There really are spikes. But since I'm making a model for ratios, we're going to model this thing as a continuous function, which is the next slide, which is just the same exponential with this constant added, with the noctin measured level of FA3 added. And I would point out that this measured level is measured, right? So now the reason I want to model this as a continuous curve is because I want to just divide. I want to take a ratio, okay? Because what we want to look at is what is this ratio as a function along this nasal temporal axis. So the next curve is just this thing divided by this thing, right? The reason we want to do that is because we want to get at this issue of this collapse that we see here, all right? So the model is that this collapse occurs because the ratio at this point becomes too low, right? The ratio in this genotype, the ratio between an expressing cell and non-expressing cell becomes too low, right? So we want to know what that ratio is, because we've measured this collapse point, 76%. Okay, the next slide, I think, is, we've basically divided this curve by this curve, because we want to see at this position, what is this ratio and what's the function? So in the next slide, is this ratio function? It's just dividing the knock-in by the wild-type exponential. And you get this curve here. And this is the measured collapse point. So this is experimentally determined. So we asked to see what is that ratio. And it's just labeled here as a limit discrimination. It's 1.33. So the model is that below 33% difference in signaling during this period of competition for target, that the system can't discriminate. Right? That's the cutoff. So what are the predictions of this? How can you test this model? Well, one prediction is that we should never reach this ratio, if this is really the thing, we should never reach this ratio in the homozygote knock-ins, right? So in the next slide is, in the homozygotes, we have these things twice as high. We know this map is never collapses. Remember, it's duplicated throughout. There is no collapse point. So we shouldn't reach that ratio. So this is just a continuous curve that models this discontinuous function, right? We divide this curve by this curve, next slide, and that's just this, and sure enough, this line never reaches the collapse point. It never reaches 1.33. So that's at least a prediction that's consistent with what we've measured. We don't reach this. But now because we're doing this in the mouse and because we have molecular genetics, we can beat up on this. You can change this. If it's really a ratio of the form that I told you, you can change this ratio in any number of ways. You can change it by changing the size of the spikes, or you can change it by changing what the level of the FA receptor is that the spikes are resting on. So there is a knockout for FA4 and FA5 and FA6. So we can take away those individual components of the gradient. We can take away half the FA4, we can take away all the FA4, we can take away half the FA5, take away all the FA5, et cetera, right? And since we're always talking about ratios that are greater than one, well, if you take something away from the denominator, we're really effectively going to be preferentially affecting the denominator. So we've done that. There's an FA4 knockout, all right? And FA4 is the most... Yeah, could you go to the next slide, Lewis? I'm not sure exactly what it is. Yeah, so there's a knockout for these genes. And in fact, the woman who knocked out this gene just turns out is a postdoc now in the lab next door. So we have these mice, right? We can take, since FA4 is making a big contribution to this gradient, particularly in the nasal part of the retina, it's making almost all the contribution, we can lower this net FA down to here just by taking half the FA4 away, all right? And so we've done that. We have crossed the islet two FA3 knock-ins, heterozygotes, into a mouse which now has half as much FA4. Next slide. And what is the prediction of that? Could you go? So this again is what we see in guys that have the normal level of FA4 that are heterozygous for the knock-in. This is the thing I showed you before. This is the collapse point at 76%. This is this guy here in the next slide. This is the curve we take away half the FA4. So all we've done now is just muck around with this constant, right? We've taken away, since we measured, remember, FA4 was 2.6, right? We've taken away half of it at 2.6. We've actually measured this now. We know this number is correct. This is a hard number. This isn't just bullshit. This is really the number. We've taken that away from up here, too, okay? That's the new curve. And so this is completely theoretical, right? This new curve... Now, if we take this limit, if the same limit discrimination ratio applies, it's 1.33, we go over to look to see if this intersects. First of all, it says, A, that the thing should be shifted temporally. The collapse point should be temporally. There still should be a collapse point, because we've reached this by this curve. And that collapse point should occur at 88% of the axis. Right? That's the prediction. And this is with wild-type FA4. Okay, we take away half the FA4. That's the result. So we've made this mouse. We've done the experiment. We've done the map. And here's the collapse point. And the collapse point is at 88% of the axis. Yes. We've just started. We've taken away all the FA4. The whole curve. Okay, can we predict this? So, well, yeah. I wasn't going to go into this. But, in fact, this part of the curve is equally interesting. for biologists, because if you, one of the things you see is now the separation distance between these termination zones has gone from this relatively modest, you know, 18% or so, to something which is enormous, okay? And I won't go into the rationale, but if you think just intuitively about this, and you see this is really, really prominent here in this nasal 40% of the retina. That makes sense, if you go to the next slide, because what is the receptor which is making up almost all the net FA gradient thing? It's FA4, right? These guys are not really doing much here at all. So you have proportionally very, very large effects on relative differences of expression by taking away half of this FA4. And in fact, by the model we make, that those separation distances are actually predicted. So let me just finish up by then by showing you that directly, by showing you a direct experiment which shows that this, those lower curves in the map, next slide, are actually due to the expression of the nocturnal allele. So how do we do this? So remember, this whole thing started with these islet 2 Tallac Z animals, right? Well, islet 2 is on an autosome, right? So that means there are two copies of islet 2 that are expressed in each case. So we can make a mouse which has one chromosome expressing islet 2 Tallac Z, and the other chromosome expresses islet 2 FA3. So now all the knocked-in axons are directly labeled with Tallac Z, because every cell that expresses islet 2 is going to be expressing something from both chromosomes. So we directly label all these things. So we cross these guys in. Next slide. And you get this amazing result. So now I'm showing you a section through the top of the brain. So this is a sagittal section cut like this, okay? The eye would be over here. The blue axons are coming into the, this is the superior colliculus. This is the target. So generally before you've been looking down on the surface of this thing. Now you're looking at it from the side. These axons are running in, and we're measuring how much of the rostral caudal axis, this is the rostral end, this is the caudal end, is occupied by these axons. So this is a mouse now. There's a lot of genes piled up here. This is a mouse which is has islet 2 Tallac Z, islet 2 FA3, and is wild type for FA4. And consistent with the map that I showed you, these guys occupy about 3/4 of, let's say, 76% of the rostral caudal axis. Okay? Now, we take away one allele of FA4, and zoop, these axons go all the way back here. They shrunk. So that's consistent with this lowered, this extremely lowered curve, this wide separation. So this is direct visualization that, in fact, all those axons in that lower curve indeed do correspond to the axons that are expressing the nocturnal allele. And if we quantitate this, which I think is in the next to the last slide, these are the guys that are wild type for FA4 that are heterozygous for the knock-in and heterozygous for Tallac Z. This is about 10 animals. And you can see there's remarkably good agreement between this measured level and the top level occupied by this lower curve. And if we take away half the FA4 in the next slide, sure enough, this thing soups down to here, and there's very nice agreement between this measured level and the top level occupied here. All right? So for me, I'll just finish by saying a few things. I think it's in the next sort of tie up the next slide. Of course, we can, as I said, quantitatively, we can beat up on this system now, because we have, even though I slammed knockouts at the beginning of the talk in terms of not being able to provide quantitative information because you're just taking away everything. In fact, if we combine those knockouts with the knock-ins, because of this nature of this model, you have great, great power because you're mucking around with both the denominators and the numerators. You can do this independently. And if ratios are the things that's only controlling it, you can make all these predictions and you can test them all. So all these knockouts exist. We have them in the lab. We could go through this over and over and over again. The other thing that I'll just finish talking about, because it relates to this, the sort of work that Lewis is famous in his career for, is the shape of this curve. All right. So this is this curve. The fact this curve takes something that looks like an exponential is, I think, very significant with regard to the genes which initially set these gradients up in the first place and pattern the retina. So we also study in the lab a set of transcription factors that are important in setting up both the dorsal, ventral, and nasal temporal axes of the retina. Those transcription factors are induced by, are regulated by a gene which is beloved by Lewis called sonic hedgehog, which, if you want to put it on this axis, is basically sitting here. Okay? And the activity of Sonic Hedgehog as reflected in those genes is a gradient which has the inverse shape of this one. In other words, it's high here and falls to low here. Okay? We've also, in the mouse, knocked those genes out. Right? One of those genes, called VAX2, as I said, is graded this way. We know that that gene, from genetics, is induced by Sonic Hedgehog, which is probably the key initial patterner of both the DV and MT axes in the eye. That gene is induced by Sonic Hedgehog. If we knock that gene out, we change the FA5 gradient from one which is graded like this to one which is flat. All right? So basically, in the nasal retina now, this gene comes on, and its expression level is essentially flat across this nasal temporal axis. So that evidence, that's genetic evidence that directly or indirectly, that transcription factor is acting as a repressor of this gene. All right? And since it is induced by Sonic Hedgehog, the inverse, and it's graded in this direction, let's say it's an exponential. We haven't measured it, but let's say it's an exponential. If it is an exponential, then the inverse of that exponential, the subtracting exponential going the other direction, is exactly this gradient. Okay? So now you have a model developmentally where you can take the graded action of a morphogen, which somehow, its activity must somehow be distributed across the developing tissue, and how this happens is the subject of a great deal of discussion. That gets translated into fixed levels of a transcription factor in each cell, which then regulate the expression of a read. All right? So you have a direct link now. We have this all linked genetically as well. And we have hard numbers, at least, on the shape of the readout. So we don't have to worry about, in the case of this gradient, this gradient of receptors is a reporter, essentially, for the action of the morphogen initially. And these RNA, these proteins aren't going anywhere. They're being put onto the surface of the cell, and they're acting within each cell. Right? So we don't have to worry about issues of diffusion or post-translational modification of proteins or blah, 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 all this stuff. This, I think, is very compelling evidence for the graded act, for the indirect action of a morphogen. And I think the fact that we now have hard numbers on this, we can actually, as I say, manipulate these genotypes experimentally and change these expression levels and actually test these models. It's really one of the very, very first examples where the actions of a developmental gradient, I think, can be studied directly where you have hard numbers on these things. So I'll conclude then again with Leonardo and just sort of make the point that one of the things that new techniques allow you to do is really not only to move in new directions in terms of, you know, new questions that you can ask, but it actually allows you to go back and ask some of the old salient questions which have heretofore been experimentally intractable. And I think that's one of the most compelling things about this mouse molecular genetics. We now can go in with mutants and with these kinds of things and actually do quantitative experiments and really test how gradients work, how the mapping works, how morphogens work. This gradient, as I said, is probably being set up by competition and development. And so getting back to this issue about, you know, why doesn't everybody go to the front or why doesn't everybody go to the back, the simple model we have now is that axons, you know, our results say that retinal ganglion cells axons are clearly competing for something that is limiting with respect to their number in the target. And we think that that limitation is this neurotrophic factor that induces collateral branching, that it's BDNF. And this one simple way of thinking about this is that all retinal ganglion cells express the same amount of the receptor for BDNF on their surface. That receptor is called, it's another receptor, tyrosine kinase. It's called TrkB, and we know they all express TrkB. We know BDNF induces branching. Let's say they all express the same amount. And let's say that BDNF is limiting. If there are two, if there are two neurons that are going to be mapping into the target, let's say there are three. So this is the rostral end and this is the caudal end. They're all coming in here from over the eye. One is going to eventually end up here. One is going to end up here. One is going to end up here. Because this guy has low levels of VPH receptors, this guy has intermediate levels, this guy has high levels, right? When they initially grow in, they all grow into the end, and they all start to extend collateral branches, which are consolidated in the target by binding of BDNF, which are induced by BDNF and are consolidated at the synapses by BDNF activating TrkB. They all have... Okay. Okay, now they're going to start branching. The branching is induced by BDNF. BDNF induces the branches. Once the branches are extended to their target, if they're going to stay there, that they have to see continued BDNF signaling.
And that comes from their attachment to the cells.
To their target cells, right. Okay?
And the amount. The amount of BDNF is not, they just all produce whatever it is.
There's uniform BDNF. In the model, the thing that's not known about BDNF, but that I'm positing, is that BDNF is limiting. We actually don't know that. So these branches start, okay? This guy is going to try to branch everywhere because he's, you know, perfectly happy branching everywhere. This guy is really not inclined to branch here because the EPH, the efferent levels are too high and they inhibit the polymerization of actin. So we actually know this experimentally. These guys don't branch here. They try to branch here, right? And similarly, this guy has very high levels of EPH receptor. It's not even trying to branch anyplace. It's devoting all of its efforts to branching here. So the question always is, why in this kind of model, why isn't everything fuzzy? You know, why doesn't this guy have branches everywhere back here, and why doesn't this guy, why does he end up here? Well, the model is because there's not enough room or there's not enough BDNF for everybody to branch and for all those branches to be stabilized. So if that's the case, let's say they all express the same amount of TrkB. If this guy starts to extend all these branches, the net amount of TrkB in any individual branch is going to be less than this guy. And similarly, this guy's is going to be less than this guy's. So if this guy's putting all of its TrkB in, that translates into signaling through this system, which consolidates it, then this guy is going to win out here because basically he's devoting all of his efforts to branching here, and he's getting the strongest signal through TrkB, and so he ends up here. Similarly, this guy doesn't end up here because even though he'd be perfectly happy branching there, this guy has put all of his eggs in this basket from here on out. And so if you do this for all neurons that go all the way along like this, you can easily see how this map can be played out in that way. So that's a model. You know, most features of that model have not been tested. But again, we could experimentally test this now because there are knockouts for TrkB and for BDNF. So we could decrease the amount of BDNF in the target, say, for example, by a factor of 2 if we wanted to.
You're not saying there's a gradient of TrkB expression across the retina.
No.
Simply that once your terminal enters the tectum.
The model doesn't require a gradient. In fact, when you actually look at the, I mean, Dennis and I disagree on this. He thinks he sees a very weak gradient, but when I actually look at his data, I don't see much of a gradient at all. And the model doesn't require a gradient. Well, in fact, the model works simplest if all the retinal ganglion cells are the same. They have the same amount of TrkB. No, there's no evidence of that. That hasn't been looked at quantitatively. So during this period of competition, is the concentration of TrkB in that area higher? That hasn't been looked at.
I mean, you might think you just put the same amount of TrkB into your membrane with respect to density anywhere.
So well, but I suppose so. But we do know that they express the same amount of TrkB mRNA and presumably the same amount of, back in the retina, the same amount of protein. So if one cell has the same amount of protein, and I mean it's a simple-minded thing. If I'm a cell, if Lewis and I are expressing the same amount of protein, and he's spreading membrane all over the place, and he evenly distributes that protein all over the membrane, then the concentration in the surface area is much lower than if I'm putting all of my membrane in one place and all the TrkB is going to the membrane. That's the model. It's a simple-minded model, but there's no reason necessary to believe at this point that it's not true. It's clear that BDNF is in the target. It's clear that BDNF will induce collateral branching. And so I think it's very, very plausible at this point.
And what do BDNF knockouts do?
The total knockouts die too soon. So you can't really study this because you really want to look at this in when the map is essentially mature. And so most of those animals are not healthy enough to do it. So you want to do this at like postnatal day 11 or something. So that's the problem. A conditional knockout is something you could do. If you could take, for example, the nice thing would be to have a conditional knockout which knocks out BDNF only in the superior colliculus or in subsections of the brain. And that's a possibility, but nobody has it yet.
Very impressive.
Thank you.
For a tyrosine kinase, man, you've done very good.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.